the 1999 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents session 254, a paper entitled Some Reflections on Fathers by Wayne Scow, and a paper entitled Daughterhood and Motherhood, Going Beyond Mother's Day, Categories of Success by Carol Otteson.
Professor Emeritus now. He's had a typically scholarly career with other Mormons of his time. He was co-editor of the book Peculiar People about Mormons of our time. The book that followed that book was a more personal story called Remembering Brad, about the loss of his son to AIDS. He earned a PhD in comparative literature from the University of Iowa in 1970. He has four sons and eight grandchildren. I say he's mighty symmetrical to have it just exactly like that. And maybe perfect even, Wayne. That's pretty scary. Oh, my gosh. That is pretty scary. Carol Clark Otteson will speak on daughterhood and motherhood and going beyond Mother's Day. She is a poet, a writer, and a musician. She's a former instructor of English from California State at California State University and took her master's degree at California State University. And she's also been an instructor at BYU in the Honors Department. She's published a book of poetry and the nonfiction book, L.A. Stories, The Voices of Cultural Diversity, which incidentally can be purchased at the Sunstone Bookstore if you are so inclined. We like to make it easy for everyone. As well as poems published in Dialogue and Sunstone. She received recognition for her writing in 1997 when she won the D.K. Brown Short Story Contest. This year at the Mormon Arts Festival, she also won first place in short story category with poetry. She currently serves on the Association of Mormon Letters. Her ongoing preoccupation, however, is motherhood, which, even though her children are grown, continues to frustrate, challenge, and change and reward her in profound ways. We'll take approximately 20 minutes for each paper, and then if there's time at before 3:15, we'll have some participation questions or comments. Thank you.
I all of a sudden got feeling awfully diffident about my part in what's going to happen here in the next hour. Some of you will have read Joseph Conrad's novella, The Heart of Darkness. And you might remember that there's a narrator whose name is Marlowe. And Marlowe is trying to figure a lot of things out about his life and experience. And he says at one point that he had looked forward in imagination to the point of his death. And he had assumed that at that moment, just when he was ready to pass over the threshold, that it would be a great opportunity for summing up, an opportunity for great insight. And he says, subsequently, I have come to that point. He had encountered fever in the Belgian Congo to the point where he was at death's door, and he says, I discovered with humiliation that I had nothing to say. And I'm afraid that I look at this topic and what I've written down here, everything seems pretty cliched, pretty much stuff that you've heard and thought about a million times. But then I took some consolation from the fact that we're all Mormon in here, probably mostly. And we go to sacrament meeting where it is a rather regular occurrence to hear things that we have heard many times before. And it's kind of nice to have the truisms repeated occasionally. And so at the very least, perhaps you can be generous to me and regard this in that way. Some reflections about fathers. My father died on December 21st, 1992, in his 89th year. Good lives are not always rewarded with good deaths, but his was, so far as I can tell. He died at home in his sleep. That it occurred on the night of the winter solstice has seemed appropriate to me, that it was a good time for making major transitions. I recognize my father's passing as an important milestone in my life. And although more than 6 years have slipped away since then, he is often in my thoughts. In the observations I will make here this afternoon, he is my central touchstone. Father is a name rich in connotations. We're inclined generally, at least initially, to regard it as honorific. That is evident in the fact that it is the name we give to God as a means of defining our relationship to him. While Latter-day Saint theology proclaims God to be literally the Father of our spirits, we attempt to grasp that divine mystery in part by our metaphorical understanding of the familiar term, Father. God's aspects as Father are the same that ideally we associate with our earthly fathers. Here are a few of those aspects. A father is, first of all, a defining link in the generational chain. Just as God helps to define our eternal natures, our earthly fathers connect us to our physical, emotional, cultural heritage. A father is one of two starting points from which we embark on mortal self-realization. A father is next a provider and nurturer, one who shelters us and helps to create the environment in which we grow to maturity. In this process, a father becomes a teacher, or I think I would rather say a mentor. The latter word has a connotation of highly personalized teaching and deeply committed concern for the learner. As mentor, a father has an obligation to pass on the best of his knowledge and values. He is a model after whom one can pattern oneself, one hopes. He is a counselor to whom one can turn, one hopes, with confidence. It is hard to overestimate or to overstate the importance of this role. Ideally, and certainly not least, a father is one's friend. Steadfast and steadying, challenging, understanding, and forgiving. Notice that fathers do not have a monopoly on any of these roles in our lives. Mothers similarly help to define our identities. Analogously, they nurture and teach. And we can have other providers, other mentors, other friends. But it is true that the positioning of fathers relative to us as the immediate preceding branch in our family tree, or one of the two, gives them enormous influence. Few in our lives more so. Considering these opportunities and responsibilities, it is worth observing that not all fathers in our lives are literally biologically so. Adoptive fathers and stepfathers and fathers-in-law and grandfathers may play important roles. Moreover, we quite often speak of father figures, those without formal family relationship who have a paternal influence on us. Jesus, not a father in mortality, nevertheless exhibited the ideal attributes of one in his relations with others who were less spiritually advanced. Occupational mentors can assume a paternal relationship to a younger person. Spiritual counselors, likewise, are sometimes viewed as father figures. We hear the expression, "He was like a father to me." And it usually implies respect and gratitude. A step further in this metaphorical progression brings us to educational or religious institutions that function like fathers in our lives, providing shelter, guiding, shaping, making demands. I know a good deal about the ideals of fatherhood from my religious upbringing and from my good fortune in having had a fine father. I also know something about the subject as a result of being a father myself. Experience is a powerful teacher. I know something firsthand about the challenges, the surprises, and the dangers inherent in this calling. I understand from experience why, in some cases, the word father has, unfortunately, negative connotations. Let me speak of these matters. One finds out pretty quickly on embarking upon this path that fathering is not so easy to do. Why is that? For one thing, in our scriptural texts, God the Father is the established model for paternal excellence, and in that comparison, a mortal father is bound to fall short. Fortunately, infants and small children are not yet fully aware of the father's existential ineptitude, but the father knows that lack of awareness can't last. The day inevitably comes when he falls from the heroic plane on which little Junior had hitherto elevated him. And what then? His mortal shortcomings are on display. Dad and Junior have to get used to that and go on. Everyone has to discover sooner or later that no father will always be as strong or as wise or as patient as he needs to be. Fathers don't always have their priorities straight. Fathers make mistakes. Sometimes the mistakes are benign, probably most of them are like that, and recovery is managed by those who are involved. Too often, however, as we learn daily from our mass media, the mistakes of fathers take various forms of egregious abuse, physical violence, sexual violation, emotional tyranny, that dehumanize their relationships with their children and cause those children permanent psychological damage. Sometimes warped personal values of fathers, materialism, excessive commitment to a career, excessive pursuit of pleasure, other excesses of temperament distort the evolving values of offspring. Sometimes fathers just abdicate. Literally or figuratively, they're not there. There are illnesses in our social fabric today that can be traced directly to these failures by fathers at all social and economic levels. I think that's important. It's not just the very rich, the very poor, the upper strata of society, or the lower, however those might may be defined. These things cut across all kinds of groups, all kinds of demographics. One can contemplate the complications of fatherhood from another angle. Francis Bacon once observed, "He who marries and has children gives hostages to fortune." In other words, dad becomes unavoidably vulnerable, and in a variety of ways. For example, parents usually expect to be made happy through their children. The children will be healthy, well-adjusted, intelligent, gifted, and of course, tractable. They will grow up to be just like their dad and mom, only better. They'll have values and goals that are just like the folks, or something even nobler and more socially admired. And then, surprise! Dad's vulnerability to the unpredictable is manifest when Junior and Jennifer, coming to awareness of themselves as unique individuals, do not follow the parental model. To cite just one modest example from my own experience as a father, it never occurred to me while my sons were growing up that one of them would decide not to go to college. His decision to enroll directly in the school of life seemed not only puzzling to me, but more than that, a repudiation of the paternal model, the paternal values. Over a period of time, I learned that each of my sons is unique, that each one of them is characterized by personal, authentic desires and goals dictated by his uniqueness. I had to accept that. I had to respect that principle. And to do so was a pretty long stretch for me 15 or 20 years ago. It can be humbling work, fathering, if you are paying any attention at all. I had to acknowledge that the first obligation of my sons was not to satisfy old dad's vicarious extension of his life and his choices, but to be true to themselves. I had never encountered that truth in any handbook on parenting. Thus, in one sense, our children are not ours. We are but agents to assist them without making too many claims, without exercising unrighteous dominion. Fathers are at risk in their stewardship if they fail to observe this principle. It is interesting to contemplate the current state of several of the words in our language that are associated with the concept of father. For example, paternal, paternity, and patriarchal, all of which derive from the Latin pater, or father. These words have long been privileged, but not without ambiguity. And they carry for many persons and groups in our culture extremely negative connotations. This derives from the fact that fathers, patriarchs, are inherently powerful. They are inherently authority figures in matters moral, social, and economic. And as such, they are potentially oppressors. They occupy a position of strength and privilege in relation to pre-adult children, and they often do not give up those advantages even when sons and daughters leave to found families of their own. Within their homes, they can dominate unrighteously on the strength of the power that nature and society give them. Fathers definitely are in a position to do damage. History and literature are replete with examples of sons and daughters who chafed under the harsh control of fathers unwilling to allow them to chart the course of their own lives. These are the reasons for the harsh critique now being leveled against patriarchy by some. You will occasionally hear someone say, "Don't be paternalistic." What do they mean? By connotation, they mean that one has taken a superior, condescending, or inappropriately dictatorial attitude that does not honor the dignity of another, that does not recognize his or her right to personal agency. If you ask most quickly what comes to mind when one hears the word paternity, I suspect most people will think of paternity suit. A literal as well as a figurative example of what is wrong with paternity in so many cases today. That is, some adult male has failed to accept the full responsibility of fatherhood. Where the word patriarchy is concerned, even though Latter-day Saints generally may wish to regard it as referring to great spiritual leaders, feminists and other minority critics remind us that white domination of our cultural institutions do not leap to any symbolic interpretation of what's happening here. I think I can probably read this in the dark. If you can. Here we go. Well, I think we're ready to proceed. Okay. Where the word patriarchy is concerned, even though Latter-day Saints generally may wish to regard it as referring to great spiritual leaders, feminists and other minority critics remind us that white masculine domination of our cultural institutions in the Western world, for all of its achievements, has often worked to limit opportunity for those not privileged by it. This is a critique that cannot be casually dismissed. These examples illustrate what we all know, that fathers and those who exert paternal influence are an uneven bunch in practice, and whatever our predisposition to idealize them in the abstract, they need to subject themselves continually to constructive self-examination. The notion of fatherhood, whether considered on a literal personal level or metaphorically on the level of institutions, is charged with opposite potentialities. It admits either positive opportunity or the possibility of unrighteous dominion. Fathers and fathering institutions fail when they are more concerned with their own ends than with the needs of the individuals they are positioned to serve. They fail when they do not help individuals to cultivate the unique gifts of personal identity. Fathers and fathering institutions fail when they use their power to coerce rather than to lead by example and love. They fail when they lose humility and a sense of their own fallibility. They fail significantly if they ignore the need for or refuse to allow a counterbalancing influence by the maternal. Fathers and fathering institutions succeed when they are open to examine and to respect the life choices and experiences of their children. Children, whether taken literally or figuratively. They succeed when they forego the desire for dominance and when they seek to empower those dependent on them. It is said that the best teachers are those whose goal is to make their students independent and themselves unnecessary. Unnecessary because the students, with the help of the teacher, have achieved their own unique mastery. That is the fruit ultimately by which fathering can be judged. That father has succeeded best whose relationship with the growing child has fostered in the latter self-respect, confidence, and capacity for independence, whose relationship with the adult son or daughter forgoes any extension of the inherent power advantage vested in a parent and continues as a loving and sharing relationship of friends and equals. That paternal institution is most desirable if it becomes a paternal-maternal institution. Let me read that again. That paternal institution is most desirable if it becomes a paternal-slash-maternal institution, as much a matriarchy as a patriarchy in its government and direction. The members of which commit themselves not out of fear engendered by coercive authority, but rather because the institution empowers them with opportunities to grow in freedom. I want to return now to my own father and to express my admiration for him in this context. As children, my siblings and I knew our father as a forceful personality, a family leader in a fashion that seemed right and welcome. We knew him as a strong example, but seldom, if ever at all, as an oppressor. I wanted to be just a little cautious there and acknowledge that just about everybody sometimes might wander over the line, so I didn't want to make a generalization so binding about Dad that it would not be true. But when I tried to think about anything I could remember where he oppressed us, I honestly could not think of anything. He wore the mantle of his authority lightly. He exercised his inherent power with admirable restraint. Consistently, we felt our father's respect for us. He made us think that our opinions mattered. In our home, we were never demeaned. He taught us well in word and deed, holding his views passionately, but allowing us to make separate choices as we fashioned our own lives. As adults, he made us feel that he accepted our diversity, valued it, and was open to learn from our experience. For these reasons, he was, and we continue to think of him as our good and trusted friend. My brother is here. You can ask him after if I've exaggerated anything in that paragraph. On occasions such as the recent Father's Day holiday, we honor the nobility of the high calling recognizing, as with the presidency of our country, there can well be some disparity between the ideal of the office and the inevitably fallible incumbent. We are all enmeshed in the human condition, and we should thus be tolerant, with our own shortcomings in mind, if our fathers fall short at times. We should encourage and help them to do their best. As for those of us who are fathers, perhaps the best we can do is to be humble in view of our inadequacies, honest and open with our children, patient and tolerant toward them. Finally, we should try to exemplify a life conscientiously, authentically, and undogmatically lived. Such a model will be most helpful to and respectful of the generation that follows. Such a model is one that our fathering institutions would do well to heed.
This month in the New Yorker, there was a cartoon, and it pictured a doctor consoling a woman in his waiting room, and she was just sobbing, and he said to her, "But he had clean underwear." And I thought maybe that had some metaphorical significance in our culture. But it shows that, you know, sometimes mothers are comic figures, sometimes thought of in a very sentimental way. And I'm going to set the theme for what I'm going to say with an anecdote from my life. When my son was 17 years old, he was asked to speak in church on Mother's Day. And his topic was, "My mother, a paragon of virtue." Now, I was particularly horrified with this subject, especially in his hands, and so we discussed the meaning of paragon as a prime example of excellence and how he might work around that impossibility. And he of course, ignored me. He would write his own talk. And I found myself in church with the rest of my brood, even more pained than usual on Mother's Day. But he stood up and he swaggered to the pulpit and in his loudest voice announced his topic, much to my relief, "My mother, the paradox of virtue." Now, I have a hard time believing that his error was not on purpose, but it did hit much closer to the truth. And this talk is about paradox, existential paradox that includes motherhood, a kind of direct descendant of Eve's dilemma of how she might keep contradictory commandments. She made the choice of knowledge over innocence, children over comfort, and introduced a stewardship full of briars, but also charged with such powerful positive emotion that any words about motherhood seem to fall short or are in constant danger of turning into pure sentiment. Yes, we love our parents, but they drive us crazy. We enjoy our children, but they can make us miserable. We may love our mates, but sometimes we can't stand them. How clearly I remember the morning after I brought my first child home from the hospital, looking at his finally sleeping body and saying to myself, "This is so much harder than I ever thought it would be. But it's also much better than I ever imagined." The concomitant realization that this was what my own mother went through both bonded me to my mother as well as weighted me with obligation. This duty was partially satisfied in a powerful image of my teenage. My mother in a hospital bed and me in a bed beside her, a tube stretching between us, my blood directly replenishing her blood after an operation. Years earlier, she had given her blood to make me. How much closer could we be? Yet at some point in maturation, we discover that we are very different from our mothers, and must decide for ourselves if that's acceptable. And as mothers, we must decide that our children born with a startling uniqueness are also acceptable. They are not us, not paragons, not meant to be a verification of our excellent parenting, but choosers for themselves. The sheltering impulse of early years is hard to shake, I'm finding as I get older. Parental limitations are difficult to acknowledge. I only hope that I created an atmosphere where creation was possible, knowing that loving is not synonymous with possessing, and that possessing is not necessarily loving. And today I speak of all women, and I call for an end to an emphasis on categories like single, married, adoptive, divorced. Are not all women foreordained to be mothers? I find the most lofty qualities that we associate with motherhood in women that have no children, or even in fathers. In fact, even Christ evokes maternal images in his repeated statement, "O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, how oft would I have gathered thy children together, even as a hen gathereth her chickens under her wings." In Enoch, we hear that even the earth, the great mother, wept for the abuses of mankind to her and to each other. The qualities of protective caring, affection, and sacrifice are universal qualities, which are required of all of us to be fully human. If we are to follow the Savior's admonition to be one, must we have categories? And the contradictions of Mother's Day have always bothered me, as they did a grandmother I spoke to in the chapel on Mother's Day. "I just don't like Mother's Day," she said. "I sit here and think of all the things I should have done and didn't." This is a day to honor women, yet sometimes brings discomfort or an uneasy feeling that we've fallen short of the idea of a perfect Mother's Day mother. There's the weary mother who feels condescended to with the presentation of a small plant that won't live through the week, when all she wants is a husband's validation and support. Or the younger mother who says, quote, "Mother's Day is a big guilt trip. Motherhood is hard. I'm aware with T.S. Eliot that between the ideal and the reality lies the shadow. But what a gap. It certainly isn't all beautiful children dressed in white with the temple as a background," unquote. And somehow I feel like there's irony in who's acknowledged on Mother's Day. The oldest mother, especially if they make you sit down, you know, an increment at a time, so they know just about how old you are. The youngest mother, you know, this could be an unmarried mother, which it was in our ward. And or the one with the most children, that's the worst. I think we should recognize the mother who has the worst children. The woman who has never been able to have any children. The woman who must work instead of stay home. The woman raising her children alone. Or better still, single out no one. Only acknowledging the mother's mothering qualities. In fact, could we emphasize these qualities from the pulpit, the presiding officer acting as a great, great comforter, not one who lulls us into complacency, but who gathers us under the down of the wings of God, provides the nurturing confirmation that mothering is hard, and offers no guarantee of success. Motherhood and lifehood, like other creative activities, require the holding of two ideas simultaneously, much like Jerome Rothenberg's description of the process of writing a poem or creating a work of art. Now, Rothenberg's theory is that in the creative process, opposites are conceived of simultaneously as existing side by side as equally operative and equally true. And he uses the image of the Roman deity, Janus, the god whose many faces looked in several opposite directions at the same time. Has your child ever accused you of having eyes in the back of your head? My sense is that if this creative principle is operative in the mothering process, that if we employ this tolerance for ambiguity, we can not only cope more successfully, but actually make a world that, like a work of art, is whole, and that will help our children with the conflicts of a paradoxical existence. In a musical sense, Leonard Bernstein cites the example of Mozart's G minor symphony. Quote, "Do you see in it the beauty of ambiguity? It's the combination of those two contradictory forces, chromaticism and diatonicism, operating at the same time that make this symphony so expressive." Unquote. The contradictions in our feelings about our children, our spouses, our religion, although puzzling, confounding, and furtive, are signs that we are living, and that if somehow we manage to achieve that divine equipoise, we are on our way to the art of the divine. And if we feel that our caregiving didn't work, if there's a huge discrepancy between the first view of those perfect tiny fingers and the imperfect, totally unimagined, almost adults we encounter as our children grow, Orson F. Whitney says, quote, "You parents of the willful and the wayward, don't give them up. They are not utterly lost. The shepherd will find his sheep. They were his before they were yours, and you cannot begin to love them as he loves them. Sooner or later, they will feel divine providence reaching out after them and drawing them back into the fold." The process theologians explain this human pull toward the good and beautiful, toward God, actually, a lure, that which is planted in all living things that brings us back to that center. It sounds vaguely familiar, doesn't it? Many times I've felt the pull of this lure from both my earthly and heavenly parents. And I think that most of us begin with the idea that we'll raise almost perfect children. The psychologist Maslow has studied the qualities of what he calls self-actualized persons, and he found that the difference between the mentally ill person and the well-adjusted person is not on a linear scale or a scale of polar opposites, but rather it's circular. It meets at the top, and here at the top of the circle you have the sane and the insane quite close together. In other words, the self-actualized person is both childlike and mature, both dependent and independent. An interesting concept, and the well person is able to achieve a precarious balance between these two extremes. Quote, "The more we understand the whole of being, the more we can tolerate inconsistencies, oppositions, and flat contradictions," unquote. Maslow intimates that this kind of perceiving is godlike, a cognition of the whole rather than just the parts. And our God, as a paragon, is both just and merciful. Once someone said to me, and you may have had this happen to you, "You are so spiritual." And I immediately wondered if this was a compliment or not. As a parent, I felt very much in the temporal realm of diapers and sticky kitchen counters. And so I wrote this reply to "You are a spiritual person." "Something wants spiritual, yet hesitates, not wanting to show a lack of substance, intellect, to not win at tennis or good looks, or socially be nil. Lose keys, pray them back. A blimp of spirit air, one rope barely attached to the ground. Listen, Descartes. To split the body from the spirit is to take the hair from the scalp, mind from the brain, sex from my prayers, God from the sandals I have worn for years. For I find I am a pattern on my kitchen floor, bonded to the sink, marked on the woodwork, riveted to the ceremonious instinctual feeding of bodies, wondering about a bed of nails, cross again, I know not what I do, kneeling to clean the floor, nothing rises past my plastic ceiling, duty has no wings, words do not fly. But something does. Spins from the walls, brings the sky down, rests on my sill, touches my body with purple and fine linen. Yes, I believe that somehow we must endow the mundane with greater meaning. That all the temporal must be spiritual, that every act has a spiritual part. And I don't think that instinct is enough to make a good mother. Even a tolerance for ambiguity or study or love are not enough for this greatest of all tasks. Like the two ways to perfection in Buddhism, one, the way of self-power, and one, the way of other power, I must add to my mothering grace. I must draw God into this work, hoping that I might, quote, be carried to my goal with the help of a great external power. Those who take the hard way seek their own greatness. Those who follow the easy way surrender themselves, reflecting on their own smallness. I would teach children to see an incarnate being they cannot see, a being that speaks in one of the greatest of ironies. If you would find yourself, you must lose yourself. I know that the gap in that circle can only be completed by the great external enabler who circumscribes all truth into one great whole. For surely it is a lifetime work, this learning to be a woman, until at the end, what is clear is the marvelous skill to make life grow in all its forms, is knowing where to ask and where to yield, where to sow, where to plow the field, where to kill the heart or let it live, to be Eve, the giver of knowledge, the lover, to be Mary, the shield, the healer, and the mother. The balance is eternal. The love and the pain, the suffering and the exquisite joy are exemplified for me in the image of my own mother, who at the age of 40 lay dying from cancer. If death can be positive, if suffering can be an aesthetic experience, if one can be both a heroine and yet not always fearless, then her experience stands. Her first thought as I entered her bedroom one day shortly before her death was not of her own pain, but of the grandchildren she would never see. I was a teenager, and in the confusion of drugs, she spoke to me. Get the material out of the closet for the chiffon bonnet for your baby. I must get it made, and the dress too, with the rosebuds. Of course, there was no baby, no material. I was stunned. but I walked to the closet, pretended to get the chiffon, took it to her, and placed it in her hands. "Thank you so much," she whispered, and drifted back to sleep, feeling her obligation filled. And how had she lived? Her patriarchal blessing said sickness would be banished from her home. Yet it was not. Her reply was that all the facts were not in yet. In the absence of a breast, she used her prosthesis as a pincushion and laughed to tears when she shocked the postman at the door with an array of pins over her chest. She was a woman who stubbornly would not abort the baby she was carrying when she had her breast removed, though her life and the normalcy of the baby were in jeopardy. 6 months later, she bore a son that George Albert Smith called in a healing blessing, a child of promise. Like Gerald Manley Hopkins, she was absolute in this one fact, that over the dark world broods the Holy Ghost with warm breast and, bright wings. This assurance allowed her to live with irresolution, allowed her to make out of James' blooming, buzzing confusion of the world a whole, a circle engraved with the scripture, "Be still and know that I am God." She showed us that in a world of opposites and of seeing through a glass darkly, one can wait patiently for more information, suspend resolution with hope, and live a life of stunning wholeness.
I'm stunned. Would you like to have some discussion? Does anybody want to make a comment or ask either of the speakers something? Yes.
The question was, did the proclamation relative to the family from the First Presidency several years ago alter, help me at this point, to change our traditional thoughts about the family? Well, I confess that when I read it, that was not something that I was looking to see at that point. Some of you may be aware that one important aspect of our family life in recent years was the homosexuality of my eldest son, and how we attempted to think about that reality in the context of what it meant for our family and for his future in relation to the concept of family. And that was very much on my mind at the time I read that proclamation, and for me it did not bring comfort, but seem to define family more narrowly than I would wish to have seen it defined. On the other hand, what you have just observed about it is a happy direction, and I'm glad that you pointed that out to me.
I'm going to repeat the question for the sake of the tape, and if you would please speak right directly into the microphone. I have another question, Michael. We should have gotten that on tape.
That was lovely.
Yes.
Very nice.
As I prepared the talk, I felt that way, that we were talking about parenthood, and Wayne and I did not share our talks with each other, nor had I met him until today, but it was interesting that we had several common points that we made, and I think the emphasis was on the qualities of parents, and that they would be very similar. Whether the roles are the same, whether the categories are necessary. I think probably, yes, they are. And I think in our individual homes, we decide on those tasks. We decide who will do what. And that's the part of the negotiation of marriage, is that you decide which parts you're going to take. And there are some that you would have in common.
I like the thrust of what you're saying. I will tell you that the origin of the talk that I gave today was an assigned presentation in a sacrament meeting on Father's Day. So, in fact, it had that individual male slant as opposed to a male-female slant. But setting that aside, I think what you say is absolutely appropriate. It does seem to me that what's really involved here are a set of principles that govern relationships between individuals, and particularly those who are in a position to guide, nurture, and help in the development of younger, less experienced people. And I find that the principles that obtain for fathers are very much similar to those that obtain for mothers, so far as I can see. If you think back about your experience with teachers in school, from grade school up to the university, distinguishing between male and female teachers doesn't seem like a very important exercise, does it? There were good teachers of both genders, and what distinguished them was not the gender, but what they did with the opportunity to nurture some younger person, some less experienced person. So you make a good point.
Yes.
Can I say something that doesn't mean anything at all?
Of course. That's what you're here for. Any other questions or comments? We have about 2 more minutes. Yes. May I just speak one word concerning the former, whoever this person is over there in the corner, that priesthood can't seem to get it right. In my house, I really wish the priest would do anything at all, anything. So whatever they would do would be just perfect for me. Doesn't matter at all. The ward, the elders, the bishop, anybody at all, the visiting teachers, the home teachers, anybody. So I hope you'll take courage and just do what you think is right no matter what. Thanks for coming to the session of Sunstone.
Pleasure to share that time with you.
So nice to meet you. Appreciate it.